This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we continue our series Tell Me Mobile. New research shows minorities are outpacing white users when it comes to handheld devices and those data applications for those devices. Earlier in the week, we talked about how this phenomenon might be closing the digital divide, but in a few minutes, we'll ask if there is a downside to this. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we wanted to talk a bit more about the issues raised by the Shirley Sherrod story. Specifically, we wanted to talk about issues of technology and journalism and ethics. Just to recap, in less than 24 hours, Shirley Sherrod has gone from being publicly vilified as a racist, pressured to quit her job at the Department of Agriculture, to being offered her job back and apologized to, all because of a long speech that was edited and placed on YouTube by a conservative activist with a record of playing a role in provocative media stunts. We wanted to talk more about what the arc of this story says about the current media environment and specifically what role social media may play in that. So we've called our own Andy Carvin. He's a senior strategist with NPR. He runs our social media desk. He's here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Also with us is Richard Prince. He's a veteran journalist and media critic and author of Journalisms. That's an online publication about diversity issues in the media. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So, Richard, let me start with you. I want to get a quick reaction from each of you. What do you think this story is about? Howie Kurtz of The Washington Post, who covers the media, wrote this morning that Shirley Sherrod might be the only official ever dismissed because of the fear of being denounced by Glenn Beck. That's, of course, the Fox News talk show host who's campaigned against other White House employees and famously called President Obama a racist. But I want to ask you, is this fear of Glenn Beck or is this story about something else?
Well, one of the things it is about is fear of Glenn Beck and the kind of opinion mongering that he represents, and the fact that the media and the administration are on the defensive against this kind of thing. I believe that this represents a danger to traditional journalism as truth tellers, and that the public needs to, instead of cheering Glenn Beck, cheer calls to get to the bottom of things and to tell the truth.
Well, some people might argue that this was a victory for that kind of truth telling because when the fuller story became clear, the situation was addressed rather quickly. So, Richard, very
right.
quickly,
when
some people might argue this is an object lesson of the other, which is why traditional media methods, checking context and all that, really do matter and are vindicated.
That's true if it had happened earlier. But in the meantime, as I remember that during the Reagan administration, the Secretary of Labor, Ray Donovan, was the victim of the Abscam case. And he said, when it was all over, where do I go to get my reputation back? The vindication didn't happen soon enough. It should have happened before anything ever aired.
Andy Carvin, what about you? Is this about the power of YouTube? I mean, this isn't the first video piece that's appeared on YouTube that can cause a significant reaction. Andrew Breitbart, who posted this edited video of Shirley Sherrod, was earlier involved in this other incident where these two activists dressed up as what they said were a pimp and a prostitute in order to discredit the group Acorn, and really did succeed in causing serious damage to that organization. So is this about YouTube or is this about something else?
I think it's less about YouTube because this could have been put on any number of platforms. I think it's more about our collective complacency, that when it was posted, many people jumped on the story and didn't bother to ask questions about its ultimate context. Given the way our 24-hour news cycle works and how social media in some ways speeds it up even more so, we don't always step back to take a moment and think, what exactly is going on here? Is there more to it? Is it solely a 2.5-minute video, or was there a larger context in which a greater meaning might be lost in this current situation?
And who is it, you're saying, who is it in your view who lacks this context? Is it when this story was originally picked up by the so-called mainstream media, for example, the Washington Post website, Ed O'Keefe, or ABC News, Ed O'Keefe on his blog, it was after the NAACP had already denounced her and the Agriculture Department, her employers were already denouncing her.
Well, I think it was a number of players taking place here. NAACP probably should have been a lot faster at getting the full video out, or at least putting out a statement saying that there's much more to this situation, and as soon as we can post the video, we can. But at the same time, if you're a blogger or working at a news organization and you have this clip and you see that it's fairly tightly edited, even though it has long portions of unedited speech in it, it's still, we're looking at about 2 minutes of video. studio here. And chances are you could take a guess that her presentation at this event was longer than a 2 or 3 minute speech. And so so as a reporter or as an editor, you should still have that healthy skepticism and ask yourself and ask your colleagues what else is going on here. And so the story had taken on a life of its own because she clearly was in trouble.
Well, they were trying to get ahead of the story. All these institutions were trying to get ahead of the story.
Exactly, because given how these stories take on a life of their own online and as well on talk radio and other media platforms, sometimes it didn't feel necessary for them to dig a little deeper into what's going on here. And so that opportunity was lost.
Andy, I'm going to ask you this, and Richard, I'm going to ask you this to follow up on this. There's a growing discussion within the online community about whether some standards need to be imposed. I mean, earlier there have been conversations about sponsorship, like corporate sponsorship, and whether you need to be more transparent about saying that I was given this tube of lipstick before I reviewed it. I'm giving these things for free, things of that sort. And I wondered, is there any online discussion going on about standards in presenting information along these lines? Because it's very clear that this information, you know, was edited, and clearly Andrew Breitbart didn't seem to feel any responsibility to present the broader context. But he's not a journalist. He's an activist. He's a provocateur. He's advancing a side. Is there any conversation about standards online?
I don't think there's a serious conversation simply because this isn't really that different than if you look at political ads during campaigns where opponents will selectively take bits of information to put their adversary in the worst possible light. It's all rhetorical strategy. That's what's going on here. When it comes to bloggers, this and anyone else online for that matter, this is really a free speech issue, and you have just as much of a right to use rhetorical arguments, even ones that are somewhat questionable, to support your own side.
Richard, do you think race plays a role in this? I mean, if the subject were something else, not a racially charged conversation, do you think that the same effect would have been had? If it was gender or some other topic, what do you think race? What role do you think race plays in the way this whole thing ensued?
Well, I think race is, is a big part of this, of course, but from the journalism angle, I think race and diversity play a role. One of the things that's happening in our media right now is this transformation to the internet means we're losing a lot of the old veterans who say, this just doesn't smell right. You have younger people. You have people who – you don't have enough of a diversity of people who can use their own experiences to judge the worth of a story, the truth of a story. If I can just take a point of personal privilege here now. The last time I was on here, we were talking about Helen Thomas, who was the White House columnist who said Israelis should get the hell out of Palestine. And we were all wondering, how could she say such a thing? And everyone denounced it and said, what a shame. Well, after that, I talked with her family and some Arab Americans who said that when she said Palestine, she was not talking about the 1947 Palestine. She was talking about Palestine as it exists now, which is the West Bank and Gaza, and the people who are going into those settlements. Well, that interpretation of what she meant was not transmitted through the media because there are not enough people who have that understanding of where those folks are coming from.
I see.
And I had the heck of a time trying to get people to even acknowledge that there was another side to this.
I see. We're going to have to leave it there. There's clearly more to talk about, and so I thank you for that. Richard Prince is a veteran journalist and media critic. As we know, the time is one thing they're not making any more of. He's
right.
The author of Journalisms. That's an online publication about diversity issues in the media. He joined us from member station WETA in Virginia. Andy Carvin follows all things social media here at NPR. He's our senior strategist. He was here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This next story is about ice cream, but a metaphor might be useful in serving up this tale. Think of a company that has to make a few layoffs. Someone's got to go. Someone who might be popular or who's sweetened the bottom line. In this case, we're talking about the Baskin-Robbins ice cream chain. And though they offer 31 flavors on any given day, they keep a stable of 1,300 recipes. Too many, apparently, because the company is going to retire five flavors. caramel praline cheesecake, campfire s'mores, apple pie a la mode, super fudge truffle, and French vanilla. French vanilla. Well, that made us curious, so we called on Bruce Tharp. He's a consultant for the ice cream industry, and he's going to explain why French vanilla is now getting the deep freeze. Mr. Tharp, we should say that you know a thing or two about ice cream. You teach ice cream food science at Penn State University. You won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Ice Cream Association. So does this make sense to you? Is this a smart move for Baskin-Robbins?
Well, I'm not going to pass judgment on whether it's smart or not. It is surprising because French vanilla does have a strong following among ice cream consumers.
What's the difference between French vanilla and regular vanilla?
French vanilla is distinguished from regular vanilla by the presence of egg yolks. It gives it a little bit of yellowish color, although that can be manipulated by whatever types of colors are added. What it does do is give it a characteristic flavor, a sort of an egg custard flavor that people associate with that.
So why would Baskin-Robbins move away from this? What would be a possible explanation?
Well, it's hard to go inside their heads and decide why they would do it. It's possible, however, just speculating, that they may see that there is not a big consumer differentiation between French vanilla and regular vanilla, and it would be having two flavors in their line at any given time, which are quite similar to each other. And so they may want to make room for something else.
What do you think the reaction will be when people head to Baskin-Robbins and realize that French vanilla is no longer on the menu?
Well, it's going to be a strong reaction among those who are devoted to that product. It's already showing up on the Internet in various blogs and things here and there. People ranting about the removal of their favorite flavor, something they hold holy or something like that.
Well, why are they ranting about French vanilla and not about campfire s'mores or apple pie a la mode?
Well, I think that the appeal of French vanilla has been a lot broader than those other ones, and it's been around for a much longer time. These other flavors are more temporal flavors, whereas French vanilla is part of history.
Now, what is the history of French vanilla ice cream?
Well, it's been part of the ice cream industry's product line for a very long time. I don't know for sure when it began, but it probably goes way back to colonial days. Egg yolks show up in very old ice cream recipes, including some that were made by Thomas Jefferson and George Washington.
And where did they make their ice cream?
They made it in their kitchens.
Hmm. The old-fashioned way, with a hand crank?
That was even before the days of the hand crank. The hand crank didn't come along until about the 1840s. Before that, ice cream was made just by putting a bowl down in some ice and salt and stirring it up with some kind of a paddle.
And stirring and stirring and stirring. You'd have to do a lot of stirring, wouldn't you?
Ad infinitum.
Well, Mr. Tharp, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. I think I have to go and see if there's ice cream in the freezer here at NPR.
Well, I'll do the same thing here, Michelle, and thank you very much for
Bon appetit. Thank you.
Bye.
That's Bruce Tharp. He teaches ice cream food science at Penn State, and he also won the Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Ice Cream Association. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. 3 months after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded and sank to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, the oil industry says it now has a plan to address such disasters in the future. Four of the biggest companies, Chevron, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and Royal Dutch Shell, are putting up at least $1 billion. Their goal is to design and build what is essentially a giant oil cleanup machine. Their plan may or may not actually improve future cleanup efforts. Then again, that isn't the company's only objective, as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The giant oil slick has left a huge stain on the reputation of the entire oil industry. Marvin Odom is president of Shell Oil, and even he says so.
The accident that has occurred, tragic accident that's occurred in the Gulf of Mexico, has changed the way the public, politicians, and even the companies look at this business. And it's a different perception of the risk involved in the business.
Odom says the disaster prompted the industry to consider better prevention mechanisms, and over the last month, a team of 40 engineers have been working on a system that would help contain oil in the event of future spills in the Gulf. The companies will fund a joint venture, which is developing the system of vessels, pipes, and subsea machines. They promise the system will be able to deploy within 24 hours and operate in waters nearly 2 miles deep under harsh weather conditions. When complete, the system will contain 100,000 barrels of spilled oil a day. The real significance of this partnership, however, may not be what it achieves technically, but what it signals to Washington. And the companies have been selling its ideas to the Obama administration and members of Congress.
Frankly, we have to restore the trust of the government and the American public in this industry and what we can do safely.
And Odom says he thinks if this group can prove it can be better at preventing blowouts and that it can react to contain any future disasters, the administration might be more likely to support lifting the ban on offshore drilling. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs today acknowledged the industry is addressing a gap that needed to be filled, but he also said the administration stands by the moratorium. Amy Myers Jaffe says she believes over time this partnership will ease the moratorium. She is director of Rice University's Baker Institute Energy Forum.
In the past, I've been very critical of the fact that there wasn't an existing technology initially on.
BP was caught flat-footed with no functional plan to cap or contain a broken well. But this move announced yesterday has changed Jaffe's attitude toward the rest of the industry.
In a country where leadership in corporations and on Wall Street have not responded with any kind of solutions to any of the problems that have come up in the last 2 or 5 years in American business, the fact that these companies in, 60, 90 days are out here with an announcement of a $1 billion commitment to actually create a solution in a consortium fashion is pretty impressive.
She says it restores her faith that the industry is capable of engineering solutions to its own problems and that it cares. BP is not currently a part of this effort, but the companies say they expect it and many of the other oil and gas operators in the Gulf of Mexico to join the project. And Shell's Odom also says he expects the system will be up and running within the next year and a half. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today was the last mountain stage of the Tour de France, with riders battling on the slopes of the Pyrenees. Lance Armstrong made a decent showing. He came in 17th out of 171 riders, but it was the two lead riders who fought for dominance. Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck kept Tour fans on the edge of their mountainside seats for most of the day. Eleanor Beardsley reports.
The day came down to a contest between the world's best climber, Spaniard Alberto Contador, and the world's youngest up-and-coming rider, Luxembourger Andy Schleck. The battle took place on the Pyrenees' second-highest climb up to the 7,000-foot Tourmalet Pass. Schleck, 8 seconds behind Contador overall, knew he had to make time on the Spaniard if he wanted to have a chance to win the Tour. He set a furious pace, but Contador always stayed on his wheel. At 6 miles to go, Contador accelerated, but he couldn't lose Schleck either. The two men left the other riders behind in the mist and crossed the finish line, separated by less than a bike length. Schleck won the stage, but he's still 8 seconds behind Contador. Bruce Hildenbrand is following the Tour for magazine Velo News.
Today we saw an incredible drama. The Tour de France is not just about one rider going as hard as they can, it's about competition. We remember back in the Lance Armstrong days when Lance was racing against Jan Ulrich. That was the big rivalry. So a great rivalry is developing here. They're both young guys. Andy Schleck is just 25 and Contador is 27, so we'll see this rivalry around for a while.
Towns and villages across the region have been celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Tour coming through the Pyrenees. In 1910, riders called race organizers assassins for making them climb the Tourmalet Pass. Today, riders set out in better spirits with a parade send-off in the town of Pau. 75-year-old Michel Delbès was one of the thousands who came out to watch the start.
The Tour de France is the biggest of sporting events for us. It brings everyone together, no matter what their age. No one is left out. It's a beautiful sport and a great show.
All day long, thousands of people streamed up the tiny mountain road to try to get a place at the finish line. The green velvet slopes of the Pyrenees were speckled with pup tents amid the confused sheep. Some fans had been camping for days to save their spot.
Are you going to talk about the cyclists?
Londoners Jonathan de Villiers and Isabel Best rode their bikes to the top with daughters Penelope and Matilda in tow.
It's nice because you dump the car and then you ride up the route and you get some of the acclaim that the pros do, especially when you're pulling two little kids.
The dense fog and intermittent rain didn't seem to dampen enthusiasm. Bright colored flags were worn like cloaks and waved as the riders finished. Whoever wins the Tour on Sunday, both Contador and Schleck can go to Paris satisfied that they tested each other to the limit today. The two men are rivals, but also friends, and embraced at the finish after fighting all the way up the Pyrenees. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, at the Tourmalet Pass in the French Pyrenees.